Fantasy Realm Radio for September 17th, 2017.
It's 12 o'clock.
On the radio when you're in the area and streaming worldwide on the web when you're not. Free apps for smartphones and tablets at wool.fm. This is Black Sheep Radio, WOOL-FM 91.5, Bellows Falls, community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.
Hello, Bellows Falls. I'm KMO. This is Sea Realm Radio. And for those of you listening in the future, I know that's the bulk of you, today is Sunday, the 17th of September, 2017. And in this episode of the podcast, I have another conversation lined up with Keith Preston. He is the author of several books, including Beyond the End of History and also The Failure of Anarchism. Keith, are you there?
I am here.
Hey, excellent. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to be back.
So what I need to do right now is give a robot a shot. Folks listening online won't know that the program before this was Radio EcoShock, and the last guest was John Michael Greer. Guest or host, Alex Smith, asked John Michael,
"What do you think of the many predictions that artificial intelligence will replace most of the current workforce, creating a new class of poverty?"
They've been saying that since before I was born. It was always going to happen 10 years from now. When I mean, seriously, in 1960, they were saying by 1970, 85% of all jobs in America will be replaced by robots. The secret, of course, is that as our economy winds down, as the vast, you know, attempting to prop up an economy that was once propped up by cheap fossil fuels on an endless supply of debt, as that breaks down, a lot of jobs are going away. It's not a matter of people being replaced by robots. It's a matter of an economy coming unglued and people having to step down toward other ways of making a living that don't necessarily feed the pockets of the rich. It's very, very convenient for people who don't want to look at the end of progress to say, "Oh, no, no, all this unemployment, it's because of robots, it's because of AI. We have to focus on this idea of progress ever into the future." It's falling dead at our feet. Right now, the great god progress, you know, remember Nietzsche said God is dead. We need a new Nietzsche to say progress is dead, okay? No, there's no heartbeat. There's no pulse. It's lying there, twitching in front of us. Let's do something else.
And John Michael Greer dismissed that as basically just another fantasy of techno-utopianism, and that it's it will be used as an excuse to account for the fact that the petroleum-powered economy is just coming unraveled. We'll say that robots are taking the jobs when, in fact, you know, the economy is just falling apart for other reasons. But along those lines, last week I conducted a little experiment. I have some public service announcements that I need to read at the beginning of the program, and I turned that job over to a text-to-speech app online, and listeners agreed it was pretty unlistenable. So I had it playing at a fast speed, and it had a British accent. Maybe that was to blame. So I have a different app I'm going to try out here. I think this one's going to be a little bit easier on the ears. So here is, what is this? Naturalreaders.com. This is their free service.
"Calling all artists and photographers. Tuesday, September 19th, 2017. Participant call for a 10/7 and 10/8 event. Saxton's River Art Guild. Saxton's River. Saxton's River, VT. Participant call for a 10/7 and 10/8 event. The Saxton's River Art Guild is looking for fine art photographers and artists to participate in their annual Fall Arts Festival. This year's event will take place October 7th and 8th from 1,000 to 400 at the picturesque Walpole Town Hall in Walpole, NH. Cost of an 8x10 space will be $25 for both days. Exhibitors must provide their own displays and stands. To sign up or get more information, please contact Donna Lund at 603-835-2387. The Saxton's River Art Guild is a non-profit organization whose purpose is to promote and encourage the advancement of fine arts. The group has membership throughout the Connecticut River Valley. And now it's time for the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
Okay, so the voice to text doesn't like the date format of month/year. It reads that as a fraction. Good to know. And now for a comparison, I'm going to read a different announcement. And this is a cold reading, which is to say I have never read this before. So this is still human versus computer. Honey House Celebration, Sunday, September 17th, 2017. 2 p.m. to 6 p.m., Linden Apiaries, 18 McLean Road, Alstead, New Hampshire. Charles Frederick Andros and Linden Apiaries celebrate the new Honey House with a party and music featuring Draw Hobbs, starting at 2 p.m. on September 17th at 18 McLean Road in Walpole. Look for the Linden AP signs. Linden Apiaries has been providing honey, bee products, equipment, education, and good community vibes since 1973. Again, that's Linden Apiaries at 18 McLean Road, Walpole, New Hampshire, 603-756-9056. And if you didn't catch that, or if you'd like to find out about other events happening in your area, then check out blacksheepradio.org and scroll down to the bottom of the page on the left-hand side. You'll see a link. It says Mid-River Bulletin Board. And if you have your own event coming up, you can submit the text for a message like the one that I just read right there on WOOL.FM or blacksheepradio.org. All righty. So, Keith, what did you think about the comparison there between a robot and a human reading public service announcements?
I tend to prefer the human approach. I think that when you use robots and these pre-recorded apps and things like that, there's a certain human element that gets lost, and it comes through in what the listener actually hears. Particularly when you're doing advertising or marketing of any kind, I think that the target audience wants to hear a human voice. They don't want to hear a computer program. I used to work in marketing, so I know a little bit about the psychology of marketing and what people will respond to and what they won't respond to. And I think that people generally like to hear a human element to anything that being promoted. When it comes across as mechanical, I think that's something of a turnoff for most people.
Although I will say that skilled comedy writers can write parts to be read by speech synthesizers, which can be very funny. And typically it's funny because the robot is saying something in a completely deadpan way, which most people would either be very uncomfortable saying aloud, or they would have to put some sort of inflection on it to excuse the fact that they're talking so bluntly about such a sensitive topic.
Yes, that's probably true, although I think comedy and marketing are probably something different. If it's something that's being done purely for the sake of spectacle or entertainment, it's one thing. I think if you're trying to get a message across, I think that's something entirely different. Now, there are certainly ways in which you could use this kind of comedic effect for the within the context of some kind of PSA or commercial advertising or whatever, but I don't think that relying on that alone is going to be very efficient or effective.
And the comedic aspect of it, using the computerized voice to say something that would definitely require a particular intonation or inflection or sort of emotional overlay if a human were to do it, that is a talent that is brought, into the mix by a human writer. This is not the computer providing the comedy.
Yeah, it's still the human element that matters. Anything that someone is going to be impressed by has got to have this human touch.
So that's nothing to do with the things that I asked you on to talk about. But if you don't mind, I'd like to stay on this topic for just a moment longer and get your opinion about the effect of automation on the ability of people to earn a living in this technological environment.
Well, I think that a problem with automation is not that we're going to go to some kind of Star Trek-like society where the robots and machines are doing all the work and people are just sitting around watching them. The more technologically sophisticated society becomes, the more we're going to have highly trained and highly skilled technical workers. So that aspect of the labor force is not only going to be present, it's going to grow and expand. Now, I think a problem with automation is not that it's putting people out of work generally as much as it's creating a class society that's much more stratified than what we saw under the older manufacturing models of the economy. Keep in mind that in the mid-20th century, the United States had the largest middle class in world history, and it was also the most prosperous middle class with the highest standard of living in world history. And that was the American way, what people used to think of as the American way during that time period. Since then, a lot of things have come along that have had the effect of eradicating that system: globalization, a range of economic policies that have been instituted by government and by industry and things like that. There's a whole lot of causes. But what has happened is that during the technological age that we're moving into now, one of the effects of that is that it's going back to the kind of two-tiered class systems that we have seen in older societies. In traditional societies and really all pre-industrial societies and even early industrial societies, what you tend to find is a system where you have the very rich at the top, you have a small middle class of professionals, and then you have a large class of poor and working class. And increasingly, we see class relations going backward in the United States in that sense. We see this widening gap between rich and poor. We see the rich are becoming the super rich. We have more and more billionaires and people with tens of billions of dollars now. But we also see the ranks of people that work in service industry jobs growing. And that is, the problem with that is that service industry jobs are much more low-paying than manufacturing jobs. The people who were traditionally working in factories are now working in retail and in service industries, hospitality industries, and things like that. And the buying power of people in those industries conventionally is about half of what someone working in a factory industry would have or manufacturing industry would have. Now, again, some of that may be offset by the growth of the market for technical workers, but that only goes so far. We do see a rising class of professionals as well working in the public sector and in the administrative sectors that are related to some of these technological fields, like healthcare, for example, and information technology. But we do see as one of the effects of this technological revolution and automation and all of the things that go with that, along with the rise of the global economy and some other factors as well, we do see this growing division between social classes. The division between rich and poor in the United States is now the widest it's been at any point in about 100 years, since before the Great Depression. Now, the comments like that have to be qualified, because we have to look at it from the perspective of relative versus absolute poverty. Most poverty that we have in the United States is relative poverty, which means that people are not able to reach the average standard of living. That's different from absolute poverty, which is life-threatening poverty. Around the world, only about 10% of poverty is absolute poverty, the kind of poverty you find in sub-Saharan Africa and places like that. Most poverty is relative poverty. That's certainly true in the United States, which is still a country that's a very high-income country per capita. But what's interesting is that while the overall wealth of the United States per capita is easily in the top 10, maybe even in the top 5 nations worldwide, our class divisions are rank us about number 35 or 40. So we're barely in the first world when it comes to the ability to level out the divisions between rich and poor. So that's a fairly significant feature there, although, that has to be qualified with the recognition that a lot of people that are statistically classified as poor in the United States would not necessarily be considered poor in sub-Saharan Africa, although absolute poverty is growing in pockets in the United States as well. And we do see more and more people working, four part-time jobs and that kind of thing to scratch by. So class divisions are widening, and the very poor, the ranks of the very poor are growing. It hasn't reached a national crisis yet, but we do see this widening class division that is happening, and automation and the technological revolution are a big part of that.
Well, I'm not worried about machines taking over my role here at the radio station, because one, this is not a paid position, so there'd be no technological or there'd be no financial incentive for anybody to devote the time and the effort and the resources to replacing me. But I resonate with what you've just said, in that I have three sources of income. I have a business that I run, and then I have two part-time jobs, and none of those provide benefits. So to me, though, that's the new American way, at least for a good part of the workforce, is working multiple part-time jobs without benefits at low pay. And it's a far cry from, 50 years ago in the United States, when we had, as you say, the world's largest middle class and the history's largest middle class. Now, it occurs to me, though, that, that largest middle class ever, maybe it was premature to describe that as the American way, because it was the result of a few special circumstances that are probably not going to recur, like the United States being the really only remaining intact industrial nation after the end of World War II. Everybody else had been smashed. And so, you know, we stepped right in and inherited the British Empire. And we had, you know, a manufacturing base and practically free energy from oil when, you know, the United States was the leading producer. This is before, you know, OPEC really got its act together and found a way to exert pressure on oil buyers. So it seems like it was always meant to be a temporary period, and that it was sort of hubris and short-sightedness to say that this is how it is and this is the defining characteristic of being, you know, of life in America.
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That was a unique time in history, and in part for the reasons you gave. The other industrial powers had been laid to waste in World War II in Europe and Asia. That left America pretty much holding the ball. And, you know, during that time period, during the post-war period, there was basically the United States, there was communism, and there was a third world, and that was about it. Over time, other nations managed to rejuvenate themselves and catch up. Of course, we know communism fell apart in some countries and liberalized its economic systems in other countries. And then a lot of the poor countries have undergone a great deal of development as well during that time. So there is more international competition now. Also, you know, there's been a range of policies that have created the kind of two-tiered class system we're seeing. For example, outsourcing is one that's certainly very important. A lot of the manufacturing that we used to have in the United States simply doesn't exist anymore. It's now in Mexico, or it's in Latin America, or Indonesia, or Pakistan, or India, or the Philippines, and all kinds of other places. And that may be good for the people in those places, because that actually has the effect of raising their standard of living in some instances. But it is having the effect in the United States of depleting our traditional working to middle class. And what we really have thought of as the middle class in American society for generations is really a working class, not a middle class. And since the era of globalization and the era of automation and all of that have come along, the American working to middle class has really taken a hit. In fact, it's probably hit us harder than virtually any other nation. It's improved the circumstances, for example, in East Asia and some other parts of the world, but we tend to be the losers when it comes to all of that. So that is a problem.
Well, you describe yourself, or particularly your intellectual history, as coming from anarchism and libertarianism, but you've got some criticisms of libertarianism. I, too, am a recovering libertarian, and one of the things that irritates me when I hear a particular brand of libertarians talk about inequality is that they are quick to point out the definition or the distinction between relative and absolute poverty. And they say, well, we don't have absolute poverty here. We have relative poverty. And really, these, you know, relatively poor people shouldn't be comparing themselves to the rich people in their society. They should be comparing themselves to how people lived in the past and recognizing that they really do have it much, much better. You know, they have reliable access to clean drinking water. They have not necessarily universal or reliable access, but, you know, if there are emergency rooms that you can go to for life-threatening emergencies, even if you don't have insurance. And really, the poor people have very little reason to complain. And then, you know, the ultimate thought stopper along these lines is, look, the poor people have iPhones, so everything is fine.
Well, there's two sides to that. I mean, yes, it's true that the majority of poverty in the United States is relative poverty, not absolute poverty. But it's also true that the ranks of the very poor are growing. I mean, we increasingly see places like Detroit, which is basically deteriorated to third world status now. And we see places like that in some of the other more impoverished areas of the Rust Belt. And we see that in Appalachia. We see that in some of the immigrant communities in the Southwest. There are parts of California now where the level of poverty is basically what you would find in the Congo or places like that. There was an analyst named Joel Kotkin who a few years ago wrote a piece called I can't remember the name of the article, but he was basically saying that there's a new feudalism that's developing in the United States, and he pointed out how California is the bellwether for this, in the sense that in California now you have the very opulently rich, like which you would find in Malibu and in the Bay Area and all of that, and in Silicon Valley and all of that stuff, and then you also have the pockets of poverty that are growing that are comparable to what you find in traditional third world model societies, like in sub-Saharan Africa and the poorest regions of Latin America, like Honduras and Guatemala and places of that nature. So that kind of disparity between rich and poor is growing, and more we are developing a type of Latin American-style class system The Latin American class system traditionally is one where you would have the very opulently wealthy, people who were as wealthy as any first world people, and then you would have the poor, the ranks of the poor, some of whom live in shanties and in the street and things like that. Brazil is a good example. Brazil is a good example where you have the places like Rio and Sao Paulo and all of that, where you have a lot of Western expatriates and so forth who live there who are very wealthy. And then you have masses of poor people living in the street in shanties and homeless and those kinds of things. And our society is moving more towards that model. It's not moving in the other direction. It may not be an emergency situation or a national crisis, but it is a problem. So we don't want to let that go, but so far, I mean, we do want to take a look at that. You know, as I said, we already have the disparity between rich and poor that you would find in terms of just the gap, the wealth gap that you would find in somewhere like Mexico or some country like that. We're barely in the first world when it comes to this kind of question. The ranks of the very poor continue to grow. There's also issues beyond material consumption, though. I mean, when we talk about situations like more and more people are having to rely on three part-time jobs, none of which have benefits, that is a problem. It's not as bad as living in say Mozambique or something where the average life expectancy is 52, but it's still a problem. However, there are other issues that are associated with the disparity between rich and poor as well, and one of them is social and political instability. If you look at countries around the world and throughout history where there is a tremendous disparity between rich and poor, you tend to see that democratic government becomes very difficult in places like that because there's no shared common values or civic values that exist between the social classes. The social classes more and more become isolated from one another. They come to view each other as enemies. And it's hard to have a democratic government when something like that happens because for a democratic government to work, there has to be a situation where the losing side, say an election, is willing to lose gracefully on the assumption that they're going to get another turn, or the losing side on some particular policy is willing to lose gracefully because they think they're going to get another turn, or they're going to win on other things. But when there's no commonality at all between either social classes or other population groups, then you tend to have a very difficult time sustaining a democratic government. And Latin America is really interesting to take a look at because it actually has a very similar history to the United States in many ways. Latin American culture is an extension of Western European culture, just like North American culture, only it's Southern European. You know, North America was colonized primarily by the English. South America was colonized primarily by the Spanish and to a lesser degree the Portuguese and the French in some places. They actually have a similar history in terms of revolutions as well, just like North America claimed its independence from Britain in the late 18th century. Canada eventually achieved its independence. So did the Latin American and Caribbean nations achieve their independence roughly during the same period, during the 19th century. However, in Latin America, they've traditionally had a lot more problems with domestic instability. Now, that's not to say the United States hasn't. We did have a civil war in the mid-19th century. But Latin America and some of the Latin American countries, they've had dozens of coups, revolutions, things like that. They've had military dictatorships. In fact, it's only been recently, and it's only been in the last few decades, that the Latin American nations have become fully democratic. I mean, just about all the countries in Latin America or the Caribbean now would more or less qualify as democracies. The one that an exception would probably be Cuba. But other than that, most of those countries more or less meet the basic standards of being a democracy. But that wasn't the case just a few decades ago. Just a few decades ago, most of those countries were military dictatorships or something similar, and had been off and on at least for a couple of centuries. The relevant lesson for that in North America is that the Latin Americans culturally are not that much different from North Americans. I mean, they speak a language that's derived from European civilization. They practice a religion that's derived from the European culture. You know, they have a similar European ethnic heritage. But they've always had this very wide gap between rich and poor in Latin America, in part because the Spanish system, the feudal system that existed on the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and Portugal, was imported into Latin America, and that the huge class dichotomy that you find in traditional societies was replicated to a greater degree in Latin America than it was in North America. In North America, we were always more of a bourgeois, industrial, commercial, middle-class-oriented society because we had this influence of English liberalism and also just British culture generally, where the Industrial Revolution started. You know, all of that was imported into the United States right away. The South America, Latin America, was different. They more or less imported the more traditional model, the more feudal-type model. And that is, as a result, they've had huge class divisions and poverty throughout their history to a much greater degree than the United States has and North America has. That's also created a lot of political instability because when you have extreme discrepancies between rich and poor in a society, usually one of two things happen. Either the elite rule by sheer repression, that is, the elite, the rich who are on top, they simply try to silence any opposition to themselves, and in extreme cases, they will ban opposition parties and labor unions and independent media, and if necessary, they'll arrest people and put them in prison or kill them if they are opposed to the establishment. Or sometimes the opposite happens, where you have demagogues and dictators who come to power promising to help the poor and things like that. You see that with Fidel Castro and Juan Perón and Hugo Chavez and some of these other characters. So it's very difficult to sustain a democratic republic and have huge disparities between rich and poor. It creates a lot of social stability. I mean, even thinkers in the ancient world recognized that huge disparities between social classes did not make for a very stable society. You even find that in Aristotle and some of those thinkers. So it is an issue. I mean, the growing disparity between rich and poor in the United States is not just a matter of, well, some people are richer than others, and that's not fair. It's not that kind of thing. It's not just an appeal to class envy. It's also the issue of social and stability as well as the fact that serious poverty is growing.
You are listening to Sea Realm Radio on Black Sheep Radio, 91.5 WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont. I'm KMO. I'm speaking with Keith Preston of AttackTheSystem.com. So, Keith, I think you have... You've led us into the topic areas that I had warned you that I would want to ask about and talk about. And let's talk about the notion of Medicare for all. Democrats, particularly, you know, elected officials and heads of the Democratic Party, are not very favorable to this. In fact, the healthcare industry is an enormous lobbyist. Washington is flooded with money from this industry. And this is an industry that would definitely take a financial hit, a very big financial hit, if we were to institute some sort of single-payer healthcare system. And so the Democratic Party is not taking up this cry, but Bernie Sanders is, and he's got a number of other Democrats who have signed on to his, I think, still forthcoming proposal to basically extend the eligibility of Medicare to everybody, or at least all U.S. citizens. How do you see this through your, you know, long historical lens? How do you see this movement to just get the phrase out there, Medicare for all, get people used to hearing it?
Well, I do think that in the future there will be a move in the United States towards a more comprehensive public social insurance system of that type, whether it's Medicare for all or something similar. Given the system that we actually have, Medicare for all is probably as good as anything we could come up with. I do think that a system like that would probably end up being means tested to some degree. There may be budgetary considerations involved. Whether we would have comprehensive Medicare for 320 million people or not, I'm not sure about. There may be some means testing issues because of potential fiscal problems involved. But I do think that something like that is inevitable given all of the problems associated with health care. One of the problems with health care is that it's a fairly unique industry in that it's labor intensive, requires an awful lot of people to keep the health care system running. It's something like 1/7 of the economy, I believe, or 1/8 of the economy. It's also capital intensive, and that's particularly true in this technological age when we have much more advanced technology than we once have. You know, it's great that we have all this advanced medical technology. It makes healthcare a lot better in terms of quality, in terms of things we can do with healthcare, but it also makes it a lot more expensive. I think the technological factor and the fact that it's so capital intensive is something that has really grown healthcare costs. Another issue with healthcare is that there's a near universal demand. It's a necessity. It's not just a luxury item. So it's a unique industry of being, in the sense of being labor intensive, capital intensive, and universal demand at the same time. Now, whenever you have any kind of product or service like that in any kind of economic system, there's going to be problems on the delivery end in terms of controlling cost, in terms of the distribution system of getting the product or service to the people that need it the most, the quickest, and things of that nature. The problem with the Obamacare system is that it was sort of a halfway measure. The Obamacare system was actually devised back in the early 1990s by a Republican think tank, the Heritage Foundation, which is a well-known think tank that's very Republican-oriented. It was actually devised by the whole system that Obamacare is based on was devised by the Heritage Foundation, and it was intended to be an alternative to the system that Bill Clinton wanted to implement in the early 90s. It was actually taken up by Mitt Romney and implemented in Massachusetts during when he was the governor there. So Obamacare was actually a Republican system that was originally created or designed at least about 25 years ago, but it wasn't actually put into place until Obama himself was elected to the presidency under a Democratic administration. So the problem with Obamacare is that it's essentially a means of creating what amounts to a monopoly for top insurance companies, and it's with a guaranteed market. You know, one of the most unpopular aspects of Obamacare is the tax penalty for people who aren't enrolled in it and things of that nature. But the idea behind that is to create a guaranteed market for the providers. And the way in that which that works through the exchange system is that the healthcare industry gets all of these different companies you were talking about. You know, they get what amounts to oligopolistic privilege to even a greater degree than what they had under the old system. Now, an antidote to that would be something like Medicare for All, but as you were pointing out, that the main obstacle to that is the fact that the healthcare oligopoly is so powerful and exercises so much control over the government. That's going to be the primary force that would block something like that, and I think that both the Democrats and the Republicans would be very resistant to trying to expand Medicare on the level you're talking about for that reason. It would provide... it would be very bad for the business interests of the conventional healthcare interests. So that's going to be an uphill battle. Now, I do think something like that will happen eventually. I think in part Obamacare may be something of a lead into that because people are not happy with Obamacare. A lot of people are complaining about how their premiums are going up on one hand, and then there's the tax penalty on the other hand, and all these other things. But nobody was really happy with the old system either. There's nobody really, well, maybe some people, but not that many people really want to go back to the system where pre-existing conditions were not insured and things like that. So nobody really wants to return to that. So the problems that are associated with Obamacare may, in fact, be a transitional phase that ushers in something more like Medicare for All or more like a single-payer system.
Could we have a Medicare for All or a single-payer system which is still highly profitable to companies like Humana?
Those at the top are always going to find a way to make a profit somehow. I actually used to work in the health insurance industry, so I know a little bit about how that works. I think there's always going to be some way for those at the top to make a big profit. I do think actually some of the more stronger objections tends to come from the more modestly sized health insurance companies and healthcare companies because they're actually the ones that tend to lose out. The big ones will probably always do okay. That was an issue even back when Clinton Care was proposed back in the early 90s. Back then, the opposition to that tended to come more from the more medium to sized insurance and healthcare companies rather than the larger ones, and that's still the case in many ways. But there's going to be profit for those at the top. you know, Medicare is profitable for those at the top in many ways because it really does create a subsidized market for them, and Medicare for All would certainly expand that. So I don't see that as being a problem. What the criticism of Medicare for All that some people have raised is that you know, there's this idea that universal health care is going to undermine the quality of health care because it's going to take away the profit motive, and then if the profit motive's not there, then there's not going to be any incentives for providers and innovation and things like that. And I don't see that happening. I mean, that's always going to be there for the large healthcare conglomerates.
You mentioned that the medical industry is fairly unique and that it's very labor intensive, and it's also there's a universal demand for it. But, you know, there's not universal access right now. If the federal government were to find a way to provide universal access to the medical system, wouldn't we need a lot more people working in it? And might that not be just an enormous boon for the economy to have a lot more people gainfully employed that way?
Yes. You know, obviously, the more you make a product or service available, the more workers you're going to have to provide it. And that's a valid point. In fact, it's actually true that in the healthcare industry now, there's a great concern about a shortage of workers in the future, particularly with nurses. There's actually a great deal of concern. If you read the literature that's in the professional journals and all of that for the healthcare industry and in the nursing profession, you see there's a lot of concern that there's going to be a shortage of nurses, that there's not going to be enough nurses to staff all the different facilities and medical centers and all of that and cover all of the jobs that have to be done. And in fact, there's more and more discussion of how to go about importing nurses from other parts of the world and providing incentives for more and more people to go into the nursing profession through financing their education and vocational training and things of that nature. So certainly there's already a demand for more workers in the healthcare industry. Something like universal health care, single payer, Medicare for All, that would even expand that even further. So healthcare is definitely a growing industry. I tell people I know, younger people, that if they really want to go into a field where there's going to be job security, go into a healthcare-related field. You can't go wrong with that.
Well, I will pass that information along to my my younger son. I think the older son is definitely headed for a job in IT, and I would be, I think, foolish to dissuade him from that course. Let's talk about the dangers of political instability that you mentioned that arise from disparity of, you know, the distribution of wealth and the hardening of class divisions and the fact that people in certain privileged bubbles don't really share much in the way of a vision or shared identity or common values with people in, you know, in the lower classes or in the less privileged positions. You've mentioned that, you know, we have primarily the poverty here in the United States and the first world generally primarily is relative poverty, but there are growing pockets of actual, you know, real poverty. Real poverty was a common experience among people living in Germany prior to the rise of the Nazi Party. Would you talk about the just give a little historical context to the setting of Weimar Germany?
Yeah, well, that's a fairly interesting story, to say the least. After World War One, Germany was essentially ruined by the war. Germany had been given a humiliating defeat in the war. The terms of surrender that were imposed on Germany at the Treaty of Versailles were very damaging. Germany was told to make damaging reparation payments for the war, in spite of the fact that the German economy had already been destroyed. Germany was prohibited under the Treaty of Versailles from having more than 100,000 troops. They were stripped of their colonial territories and overseas territories. So it was a very humiliating experience for a nation that had probably been the most advanced nation in the world prior to the war. That was compounded by the fact that the Germans, at the end of World War One, also introduced democracy for the first time. The traditional German system before that had been a kind of, you know, a monarchy, kind of a constitutional monarchy. You had a parliament that had some powers, but it was a traditional monarchy. And the Weimar Republic was introduced as a democracy, a parliamentary democracy. And during the same period, this was in the 1920s, that Germany also experienced the Great Depression. The Great Depression certainly hit the United States very hard. It was a very bad time for the United States, but it was even worse for the Germans. And there are all kinds of stories that come out of the Weimar Republic about Germans having to take a wheelbarrow full of cash to the supermarket to go grocery shopping. That's how worthless their money became, and a lot of those stories are true. So Germany had been destroyed by the war. They were devastated by the International Depression. And they had a democratic government that they were not accustomed to, and which was also very dysfunctional. One of the problems with Weimar is that it could never form a stable governing coalition that was able to effectively address problems. The center, for example, could never hold. One thing about the American political system is that it tends to be very centrist oriented. We've always had this traditional two-party system, and that drives the parties towards the middle. We don't tend to have extreme parties represented in American politics. The system is geared in such a way it pushes everything towards the middle. But what happened in Weimar is that the center could never hold. So as a result, politicians who were otherwise relatively moderate on the left and right would continually reach out to and court the far fringes of the in German politics in order to build constituencies for themselves. For example, moderately conservative or traditional nationalist politicians on the right started courting extreme revolutionary nationalists, including the kinds of elements that later became the Nazi movement. And on the left, it was the same way. Moderate liberals and moderate socialists started reaching out to the communists and groups of that nature. So you had a situation where the Weimar Republic was viewed by the German people as being very ineffectual. They were not accustomed to having democracy as a form of government. They started to think it was basically worthless, and you know they needed a more authoritarian system like they were accustomed to in their political traditions. So the whole democratic system lost its legitimacy. The state was increasingly unable to solve problems associated with the damage that had been done to Germany in the war or the Depression. And keep in mind, this was a situation where you had millions of soldiers who had been veterans of World War One, who had been demobilized. You had millions of workers out of work who were essentially starving. And you had a government that was unable to do anything about this. So the people in Germany started turning more and more to extreme parties that were promising to overthrow the Weimar Republic and create a more efficient system. It got to the point that the two largest parties in Weimar Germany were the Nazi Party on the right and the Communist Party, the KPD, which was a Stalinist party aligned with the Soviet Union, on the left. These were became the two largest parties in Germany. At that point, democracy was impossible in Germany because nobody supported it. It had simply lost its legitimacy. The most popular parties were those that were advocating abolishing democracy. That is the kind of problem that you tend to run into when you have a society that is where there's huge polarizations in the society, either along social class lines or along other lines like culture and ethnic groups and religion and things of that nature. When you have polarization, when you have the growing divisions between social classes, when you have growing ranks of the very poor, when you have a system, a government that's viewed as very inefficient and ineffective and incompetent, all of that tends to delegitimize democracy and push people towards more extreme points of view, and makes democracy a lot more difficult. Now, the United States is not comparable to Weimar Germany. It's important to point that out. In recent times, I've heard a lot of commentators arguing that. They look at incidents like what happened in Charlottesville and Berkeley and some of these other places and saying, wow, this is just like Weimar Germany. You got the far left and the far right fighting in the street. Well, in Weimar, it was much more serious. I mean, in Weimar, you had revolutionary totalitarian parties with their own private armies fighting it out, you know, gangland style in the street. It was a much more serious situation. But another problem is that we don't have the kinds of poverty that they had in Weimar Germany. They had massive unemployment, literal starvation. It was worse than the American Great Depression. Not to mention that Germany had been totally devastated by the war just a few years earlier, and they had no tradition of democratic government in the first place. So the situation is not nearly as serious in the United States today as it was in the Weimar Republic, but it is, the Weimar is something to be mindful of because it is an example of what happens potentially when you do have huge gaps between social classes, when you do have a very inefficient and unresponsive government, when you do have a democracy that cannot maintain its legitimacy, and when you have political polarization.
I live in a small town in Vermont, and there are no black bloc, you know, protesters or combatants doing battle with openly neo-Nazi right-wingers or white nationalists on the streets. It's just not part of my experience. And really, it's not part of the experience of anybody really, you know, except for a few unlikely exceptions, of anybody listening to this radio show or this podcast. And yet, if you go to Facebook, it's an enormous topic of conversation. It's one that is really hard to escape. If you have anything to say politically, you're going to hear about Antifa. You're going to hear about neo-Nazis. You're going to hear about the need for Antifa to protect us from insurgent Nazism or fascism. I think so much of this fascination and this, you know, the fact that it is an unescapable topic online right now comes down to the fact that, social media is looking to keep us engaged. It's looking to, you know, for something to keep our eyes on the screen on their website. And so it's going to magnify things that, activate our ideological defense mechanisms and reflexes. And so it's going to magnify something which could really be a very fringe and inconsequential phenomenon into something which seems imminently threatening to the stability of the United States and democracy.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things that are going on with that. One is that I talked about the class polarization that we have. We also have an extreme political polarization going on in the United States. The statistical evidence on that shows that the level of political polarization that exists in America today is about what it was in the post-Civil War period. You know, Democrats and Republicans are more divided than at any point since the Civil War period. Now, there are obviously important differences between now and the 19th century, but we do have, without question, a tremendous amount of political division and polarization. Now, as far as what's driving that, there are a lot of different factors. There are, you know, probably easily a dozen factors that could be identified that are driving that. There's a psychologist, a social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt, who has examined this in some detail and offers a lot of insights into what's driving this. But some of the basic things have to do with changes in the demographics of the country and cultural changes and generational changes. I think in particular, we have seen over the last few decades the rise of an upper middle class that is not a traditional American elite or a traditional middle class, but tends to be representative of either what sociologists call the newly rich or new money, in the sense that if you look at, for example, the kinds of business interests that back the two political parties, the Republicans tend to be more leaning towards the more traditional American plutocracy, the traditional elite, which is big banking, big government, big banking, big business, big oil, armaments, agriculture, all of that kind of stuff, the traditional American ruling class, the Chamber of Commerce. The kinds of business interests that tend to back the Democrats more extensively tend to be from newer, more high-tech industries that did not exist in traditional American society, like Silicon Valley, like Hollywood, like big media conglomerates and things of that nature. So the Republicans, I mean, there's obviously overlap and there are groups that have their hands in both, but the Republicans as a general rule are more the traditional American elite and plutocracy, the WASP elite and the big banking, big business, country club Republicans, and the Democrats are the newer, more high-tech industries. Another difference is that the demographic change and cultural change and generational change has been such that you see a lot of upward mobility among traditional minority groups and all of that. For example, there's a big thing among the Democrats now where they talk about identity politics. And what a lot of that is rooted in upward mobility among African Americans, women, gay people, people from immigrant communities. All of this, these are populations that were traditionally either excluded or discriminated against, but have gained and prospered in more recent times and have experienced upward mobility, or at least their more elite and educated members have experienced upward mobility. So we're starting to see a polarization within the elite. We're starting to see a polarization between the more traditional elite, you know, the more waspish big business elite on one hand, and the more newly rich high-tech industries on one hand, and the growing public sector and the urban professional class, which tends to be very affluent economically, but also tends to have very cosmopolitan cultural values. They have no problem with gay rights and things like that, as well as the more upwardly mobile sectors of the traditional minority groups, traditional out groups, women, et cetera. So I think that's really what's fueling the political polarization. It's actually a conflict within the elite. I did some research on this for a paper some years ago after the first Obama election. So that's been, 9 years now or something like that. But what I discovered is that the polarization tends to be primarily within the upper middle class. The super rich, that is, people who make millions of dollars or billions of dollars, tend to vote Republican fairly consistently, because they want to protect their wealth. They're conservative in their economic views. The exception to that are the super rich in some of the largest metropolitan areas. If you look at the voting patterns of the super rich in New York, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, in San Francisco, in those places, the super rich tend to vote Democratic. Within the upper middle class, the professional class, the people that are making a high five figure, low six figure incomes, you tend to see that the upper middle class is very divided between Democrats and Republicans. Interestingly, in the wealthier sectors of the United States, the upper middle class tends to be more Democratic than Republican, which I think is interesting. So this red, blue, left, right, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative polarization is largely something that's taking place among the elite and affluent classes more than the poor. So this conflict, this political polarization, is not necessarily a manifestation of the wider conflict between rich and poor, or gap that's growing between rich and poor. There are some commentators that have tried to claim that the reason we have so much political polarization has to do with the gap between rich and poor. I think that's something separate. It overlaps in ways, but I think it's also separate. I think the real basis of the red-blue conflict is rivalries within the elite. Another thing that fuels that is what you said, and that's the changes in communications technology that have taken place over the past few decades. During the same time that we have seen this polarization happen, this political polarization happen, which has been fueled by economic and technological and demographic and generational change, we've also seen changes in the way the media has structured. If we look at what the media was back in, say, the post-war period on up through the 1980s, maybe, we see that we had the three major networks. We had NBC, CBS, NBC, which tended to take a fairly centrist line on political issues, to the point where they were almost interchangeable. Now, a criticism of that is that alternative points of view were excluded, but they did tend to take a more centrist line. Now, since then, we've seen a lot more diversification of the media in terms of content, which is interesting considering that ownership of the media has actually become increasingly concentrated. Like more and more, something like 90% plus of the media, all media, electronic media, print media, is owned by just a handful of corporations. But what we see is all these little niche markets. We see, as a result of the internet and cable television and satellite television and all of these things, we see these little niche markets propping up that have their own television networks that cater to them, or their own social media pages, or their own websites, A good example, for example, is the television networks we have now. If you're a Republican-leaning, conservative-leaning, you can watch Fox News. If you're a liberal-leaning, Democratic-leaning, you can watch MSNBC. You know, MSNBC is to the left of the traditional networks. Fox is to the right of the traditional networks. With the internet, you can find all kinds of points of view. You can on the internet, you can find everything from neo-Nazi sites to communist sites, and you can get your news from any kind of source you want. It's also had the effect. One interesting thing about the internet is that it's had the effect of democratizing access to information on one hand, even as control over the media companies has become increasingly concentrated. At the same time, you can argue that it's also generated phenomena like fake news and as well as the rise of extremist points of view that are get a wider audience than they once did. So all these little dichotomies have developed as well. But as far as the polarization, I do think that the media fuels that. I think that the media has created all of these niche markets that they try to appeal to. They want to keep their audience. And part of it is keeping people inflamed over things that, on a practical level, really aren't that important. I know in my own life, I know people individually who are obsessed with Fox News or who are obsessed with right-wing talk radio or who are obsessed with MSNBC or whatever the whatever something comparable would be as far as social media or whatever. And, you know, more and more people are developing, some people are developing conspiratorial views about, you know, the Russians are running the American government and or the Koch brothers are conspiring to undermine, you know, the public interest or whatever, or George Soros, and, you know, all these kinds of things are becoming increasingly common in these kinds of ideas. I see this kind of stuff circulated all the time as though it were, you know, as though it were proven fact, you know, when it's just speculation and often nonsense. So we do see this kind of political polarization that's going on that I think is real and at the elite level. I mean, the elites really are polarized among themselves, you know, in terms of, you know, industries and technology and business interest as well as cultural and demographic interests. But it's also being fueled to a large degree by the kind of changes we've seen in media technology, in sense of media companies do have a financial interest in creating these little niche markets for themselves and keeping everyone outraged and worked up about things. As you were saying, the groups on the fringes, like the neo-Nazis, the alt-right, the Antifa, other similar groups, the Black Bloc, those are very small in number. There are very, very few people who participate in those movements on an individual level, and yet we see them represented in the media as though they were mass movements. To listen to some of the people coming from commentators from Fox News, you would think the Antifa were a mass movement or the Black Bloc were a mass movement. They can get maybe 100 people to show up at one of their events in cities where they are heavily concentrated, like say San Francisco or the Berkeley area. And the same is true with the alt-right. I mean, the alt-right had a massive rally in Charlottesville that turned into the street fight, and yet the alt-right collectively, they'd been promoting that for months. They got maybe 1,000 people to show up for that, you know. So that's actually, fairly minuscule compared to the fact that there are 320 million Americans. But at the same time, as you're saying, these movements are presented as being mass movements when they're not. They're actually very fringe movements. The part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that the media feeds on the sensational to such a great degree. And it's always been like that. I remember watching network television in the 70s and 80s when, you know, whenever a Ku Klux Klan or neo-Nazi rally would happen, you know, there might be 20 people there. And yet this was presented as being another version of the Nuremberg rally. And I think the reason for that is because the media thrives on sensationalism. The media likes to identify things that are abnormal or freakish or off the wall or controversial or seemingly threatening and amplify them. And they don't do that just with political things. I mean, they do that with anything that it can get a rise out of people. I remember a few years ago, there was a lot of hysteria over the Ebola virus. You know, I think one guy in Texas had come down with the Ebola virus, and they were trying to claim there was going to be an epidemic of Ebola. And this kind of thing just really fueled by the media.
That's definitely true. I don't think we really have time for another question and answer. We've got just over 2 minutes left in the podcast. So let me just invite you to tell folks where they can find more of your work and basically just say goodbye.
Well, if you want to find out more about me, you can go to a website called attackthesystem.com. A lot of original writing by myself is there. And a lot of essays and other material, blog posts and so forth that I've written over the years. And also, I've written about half a dozen books. You can order those directly from the website as well. All of that's available there. It's called attackthesystem.com, just like it sounds, Attack the System. I have a book by the same name. I suggest checking that out also.
All right. Well, Keith Preston, it has been a pleasure as always. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Stay well. Alrighty, that was Keith Preston of Attack the System. And that conversation didn't go quite where I had anticipated, but that's fine. I mean, it went in a different place because I had been listening to Radio EcoShock just before this show came on. So the guest there, John Michael Greer, has been a guest on the CROM podcast and not yet here on CROM Radio, but on the CROM podcast many times. So I'm very familiar with his point of view. I disagree with him in certain aspects, but I never miss his blog, or at least I didn't when he was posting regularly on the Archdruid Report. His new blog is, he updates it less frequently, and I'm just not in the habit of looking at it. So I will go and take in two or three, you know, installments at once, which, you know, for John McGreer, he writes voluminously. So that's a commitment of several hours to actually go and read multiple posts by him. Anyway, that brings us pretty much to the end of this installment of CREALM Radio. Let me invite you to check out past episodes. You can find them archived on my website. It is CREALM.com. That's the letter C, which is spelled, well, the letter C is spelled C. But the website is CREALM. It's C-R-E-A-L-M, CREALM.com. And there is a group on Facebook. It is Friends of the CREALM, where you can interact with other listeners to this program. All right, that is all for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you again in about a week's time. And until you next hear my voice, please stay well.